Hi everyone. As we near towards the end of the year, I wanted to let you know that registrations are still open for the January intake of my 12-week transformation program. Stepping Out from Behind the Smile is an immersive container that guides you through my holistic transformation model, helping you to step off the hamster wheel and start living a life you love. Whether you're looking to address your relationship with food, alcohol, money, or relationships, this program is designed to give you the tools to create a meaningful life on purpose. If you'd like to know more, you can reach out through my website, ashbutters.com, or DM me the word smile on Instagram. Let this be your sign to say yes to the life you deserve and start 2024 the way you want to live it. Welcome to Behind the Smile with Ash Butters, a podcast designed to reveal the truth behind the masks we wear. Together, we look to demystify the human mind and its behaviours in relation to mental health, trauma, and addiction. My name's Ash, and I'll be your host as we uncover the real stories of people's pain and the steps they've taken to live a life of freedom in recovery. From sobriety to spirituality, join me each week as we uncover the reasons why people seek recovery and how their lives have changed by living one day at a time. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Behind the Smile. Today's guest is Megan Webb. Meg is a mum of three and a certified This Naked Mind alcohol recovery coach. From early childhood, Meg experienced crippling anxiety, and by the age of 17, she'd developed a social phobia. Made worse by alcohol, Meg fell into a terrible cycle of self-medication, which only fueled her crippling mental health condition. After years of unsuccessfully trying to manage her drinking, Meg knew she needed to make a change. She felt unfulfilled and knew deep down that there was so much more to life. This is what led Meg to make the decision to quit drinking for the final time on the 31st of December, 2021. Meg is here today to share her story. And with that, I'd love to welcome Meg onto the show. Meg, welcome to Behind the Smile. How are you this morning?
Hi, Ash. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really good. Thank you.
Oh, I'm so excited to have this conversation. You were so kind to have me join you on your podcast, Not Drinking Today, recently. We had so much fun having that conversation, and I thought, what better way to continue the fun than to have you join me here today?
Awesome. Thank you so much. It was great having you on our podcast.
Now, Meg, I have to ask, December 31st, that's an interesting sobriety date. I mean, most people choose the 1st of January to get sober. So tell me, what happened there? What led to that day being your sobriety date?
Yes, yeah, so I didn't have a final, like, big New Year's Eve. I think for me, I have to start something. So if I started the year on the first hungover, I know it would have been harder for me mentally. So I had to start the year with a clean slate. So waking up on the first, knowing I had already that night behind me, was the start that I needed.
Yeah. And how did you manage New Year's sober? What were some of the tools or techniques that you had in place? Because I imagine that would have been really difficult.
Yeah, look, because I've got like kids that at the time we're going to be home anyway, I didn't have any big plans. So we just watched the fireworks on TV. I just kind of made it another night, you know, so something special for dinner and then 9 o'clock fireworks. And I think we're in bed, but I did find that stopping my anxiety for the first two nights was horrendous. So I didn't have a good night that night. For me, a lot of people might need GP assistance. I didn't, but I did have some minor hallucinations. That sounds pretty bad. More like panic attacks. So I was so completely into that, you know, New Year's Eve didn't really happen. And I guess that took two nights and then that was out of my system.
Wow. And so that was the detox process for you. Is that how that manifested?
Yes. So that was the detox. And I guess I mean, it was quite intense. I don't know if anyone can relate, but I had nightmares, but they kind of felt like they were real. That's the kind of hallucination. They were in the setting I was in. So it was a really horrible process, a bit of night sweats, all that kind of stuff that you think of with a detox. But it didn't take that long. The next day I was okay. It was only at night. And then from the third night, it was fine, but it was just maybe a few headaches and things like that. But thankfully 2 days was the worst of it.
You make such a good point, don't you? I was really shook when I went into rehab and they explained that I would need to be medically detoxed off alcohol, because I just didn't think that I was even drinking enough to warrant that sort of precaution. But it is such a toxic substance that when we remove it from our system, we do go through this really intense detox process. And like you said, you can experience night terrors, sweats, convulsions, and in the most extreme cases, it can cause death. So it is really important that if you're drinking a lot or drinking consistently even, and you're going to stop drinking, that you get some sort of guidance from a doctor or a medical professional.
Definitely. And looking back, I probably could have done with that. I would always recommend for people to talk to the GP, their GP first.
Yeah, sound advice. All right, let's take a couple of steps back, because I know we got straight into it there, but I would love for our audience to get to know you a little bit better, Meg. So can we kick it off with telling us, where do you live? What does an average day look like? And what do you do for fun?
Okay, yes. So I live on Sydney's Northern Beaches, just a bit back from the beach, but a very beautiful place to live. I'm very lucky. I have three kids. My eldest is 25. My youngest is 14. My daughter's just doing her HSC, so my middle daughter. So she's amazing, not too stressed, so that's nice. And I work as a teacher's aide for children with autism. So that's 4 days a week, which is very fulfilling, but it's also quite exhausting emotionally and physically, but very rewarding. And one day a week I'm doing my coaching as a job, and then with clients I fit them in around that. So
fantastic.
That's kind of my day, with a bit, you know, try to get a walk in and spend some time with the kids. So what I do for fun, well, I love walking, and I'm very lucky to live in an area where there are bush tracks, although I'm not so keen in the summer because of snakes and fires. But I've got the beaches, which is amazing. So I love walking in the local area. And I also have started ice baths. So there's the one I do is on Manly Beach on a Saturday morning. I mean, amazing.
So that's been,
so cool. I know that it's a bit of a trend at the moment, but it is so good and so worth it. I do a little bit of yoga, and then just, you know, I love to have brunches and lunches and walks with friends and that kind of stuff. So my nighttime partyings turn more into daytime lunches and things like that. So that's,
I love that.
Yeah,
it's a great way to still get that social connection without the temptation of being surrounded by alcohol.
Definitely.
And Meg, have you always been a caring person? What drew you to this line of work that you're in currently?
Yeah, I guess from a young age, I loved kids. So I remember specifically being a member of my parents' like tennis club, and there were little kids and I'd always be in charge of the little kids. I loved that. I didn't want to do teaching or anything. So I started my career as a photographer. And then when my youngest went to school, I had a friend who was a teacher's aide at this autistic school, and it's in the same suburb I live in. And I remember at first sort of saying, I don't think I could do it. But the location and the hours were so perfect that I went in for one volunteer day and fell in love with it. And I've been there for 8.5 years. So
wow.
It kind of was a happy accident, but feels like it was meant to be. So
that's beautiful. Yeah. Meg, I've asked you to bring in a photo today. Now, this photo is from a time in your life where you are hiding behind a smile. So you were presenting one version of yourself to the outside world, but the reality was internally you were struggling. Things looked really different. Can you please describe for our listeners, what am I looking at with this photo? Describe the photo, but then also can you share what was going on in your life at that time?
So this photo, and when you'd asked me to bring it along, I went through all my photos and I'm like, I forgot about it. I'm like, oh my gosh, it was a low. So I looked pretty happy, but it was almost to the day 5 years ago, just the day before I stopped drinking for the first time. And I say for the first time, because as many people know, it's an up and down journey to stopping. And it was my friend, it was just near my birthday. And my friend and I had sort of celebrated our birthday that night, but we ended up partying back at a friend's house and that photo was taken there. I don't remember much of the night, but I ended up staying there the night because I passed out and my husband didn't know where I was and my kids didn't. So in the morning, manic texts from them. I'm like, oh my God, I've never not gone home. But I was at this friend's, I was in bed, you know, I was safe, but they didn't know that. So it was a really, you know, that was a real low for me. Because normally, and I, through all my drinking, I always put my kids first. I knew they were safe. They were at home with their dad. That's fine. I always had them safe. But I hated that they worried when they woke up, you know. So it was a horrible feeling. And then I did stop that day for 5 months. And then I started drinking again. So it kind of shook me up really badly, but not quite enough to keep going.
When you stopped after that time, what were some of the ways that you sought out support to be able to stop, or did you just do it on your own?
No, I did get support. So back then I didn't know about This Naked Mind, which is who I now work for. I found, don't know if you've heard of Bex Weller. Rebecca Weller she wrote a book called The Happier Hour. And she had an online course. So it was 90 days. So I signed up for that. I probably did a week just, you know, white knuckling. And then I looked for support. So I did that with her, which was every day you checked in and had a different thing for each day. That was very helpful. And I did actually go to AA after about a month because I actually had someone at my work say, I didn't know you were that in that much trouble, because I'd sort of opened up a bit. And he said, I've got a friend who's at AA, and hooked me up with him. And then he got me in touch with a woman who became my mentor. So I loved going to AA for 4 months. And before COVID, it was great because it was in person. And I really, really loved the community. And for me, it taught me that community was going to be number one for me and for a lot of people. So I really loved it. It worked really well because my husband was at home and could have the kids and I could go to meeting every night because obviously it's quite time consuming. And that was brilliant. I think it was the 14th of February that I started drinking again, and I was at the neighbor's and I just picked up a drink. And so I stopped AA, I stopped everything and started drinking, and straight away went back to pre, you know, 5 months ago me. Quite a lot of alcohol.
Did you have any intention at that time? Were you sort of thinking to yourself, oh, look, I've done 5 months. I'm probably not that bad. Maybe one or two. I'll just try and manage it better.
You know what? The niggle had started. I think I knew somewhere along the line I was going to stop. And I think I gave myself permission. I've done 5 months. I can go back on it. There will be a day when I stop, but it'll be okay. I never thought I could moderate. I knew I couldn't, and that was shown from day one. You know, a bottle of wine after 5 months off is not moderating. So I didn't go through that so much. I did have the odd thought of, oh, I could just go out once a week, or, you know, which is a moderation of times. But yeah, it just went so quickly back that I knew along the track I would give up. And I think I just somewhere in my subconscious just went, just go for it for the moment.
And how long did that last for? What did it look like?
So COVID, so that was 2019 and COVID hit the next year. So for that year, I just kept going out with friends, and it's actually when, no, I lessened going out with friends. So probably once a month we'd get together and have a big night. I still had friends that did that. And that's when I started to drink at home. So I'd have my half bottle, my two bottles in the end. And I did start to be more of a recluse because I didn't want people judging. I wanted to drink at my own pace, which a lot of people would understand. And then when COVID hit, oh, how good was that for drinkers? I mean, I could do what I wanted, and that kind of made it worse. So that went through to September of 2021 or end of August, and I went, nah, this has got to stop. This is going to get really bad. I had one day, I think, where I drank at midday, and I thought, no, that's getting too close to morning drinking. So I did the live alcohol experiment through This Naked Mind in the September. And the course I did was where you had a coach each day, which I loved having that human on the other side, like you could talk to them and that. And there was one coach from Australia, Emma, and I remember thinking, I want to do that. Even though I just stopped and I hadn't planned my future, I want to be an alcohol recovery coach. And I did drink after that month a little bit, and then I stopped on the New Year's Eve. It was kind of that, I know this is happening now. And then I just had a little bit to drink, which when I say a little bit, it's probably a lot. And then that was it at New Year's Eve. So a few stops and starts.
Thank you for sharing that and being so honest about your journey, because I think it's so important for people to understand that no two journeys look the same, and it really doesn't matter how you get there. Like, we all end up in the same destination, God willing. But, you know, it looks different for everybody. And speaking from my own experience, I spent so many years comparing myself to people who were worse in my eyes and thinking that I didn't qualify to be an alcoholic, or, you know, my problems weren't as bad, or I would get on top of it, you know, if and when this happened. Like, I'd always say, when my husband stops taking drugs, when I get this job, when I fall pregnant, like all of these outside things that were going to help me manage and control my drinking. But at the end of the day, like, I needed to do that myself and get to that point and stop comparing myself.
Yes, definitely.
Now, Meg, having read your bio, knowing a little bit about you, I understand that a lot of your drinking came from this need to self-medicate, and there was some stuff going on with your mental health. Can we take it back now? I'd love for us to journey back to your childhood. And could you please help me paint a picture of what it was like growing up with anxiety? And was there anything in particular that triggered this for you?
So I guess I've done a fair bit of reflection in the last year and a half. And before that I had ideas. When I was little, probably about six, I saw my brother get hit by a car. Now, it wasn't a major hit. He was okay. But I think it was the first time I felt bad things can happen. So I was, that put some fear in me. It was followed then by, we had a break-in at my house as a kid. I was probably nine by this time, and then I felt unsafe in my house. And I think that's where my generalized anxiety began. And then as I went through childhood into my teenage years, I got really, really worried, particularly when my mum would go out. I'd worry till she got home. So it was, I was always worried about losing people after those things, I guess. And so it was always an underlying just fear. And that was, you know, for a kid not knowing what that was, I can see that that took a huge toll on me. I then couldn't sleep in my own room. And I was telling someone recently, I would drag my mattress into my brother's room probably at 11 o'clock when I woke up at night, and then I'd drag it back at 5 a.m. so no one knew. And that is a really dodgy sleep for someone for so long, you know. So I can see how my anxiety started to get worse. Just, you need to sleep. And I was just always on high alert. It was just a constant, and always worrying if people would be okay, my family.
Mm. That's how did you communicate this with your parents or your brother?
Yeah. No. So they didn't know how worried I was. I never could voice it. And I guess looking back, of course my parents had no clue, but after my brother was hit by the car, I probably needed to talk about it. And there were other incidences that happened that probably talking would have been helpful. And that is absolutely no one's fault. If anything, it just made me a bit aware as an adult that debriefing can be helpful, because otherwise it's all bottled up. So no, I didn't let anyone know any of that. I got very good at hiding things like that from an early age.
Mm. It's interesting that your natural instinct was to keep that a secret and to carry that burden by yourself. That would have been a really heavy weight to bear, particularly at such a young age. I had a similar incident where somebody tried to break into our house, and it was just my mum and my brother and I. My dad was on a work trip. He wasn't there. And I remember the police were called, and it was quite dramatic at the time. And it's, to this day, it's left a scar. It's been a trauma. And I still am really mindful of like locking doors and just being hypervigilant around that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So I really do understand how scary it can feel to not feel safe within your own home.
Yeah.
How did the social phobia start to play out? Because you developed that around the age of 17.
Yeah. So I feel like when I do look back, I can see that over this time, something was, you know, inside, the anxiety was growing, and probably it was going to come out in some way or another. So it was about, when I was 17, I think I was in year 11 at school, and I don't know, but someone made a comment about my body shape, because I just developed innocently, but I think it made me self-conscious, because up until then I had never been worried about my appearance. I didn't compare myself to other people. I mean, I was always quite thin. It's just that when I developed, you know, my bust got big overnight, basically, but late. So it did draw a bit of attention. I was at a girls' school though, and I just remember at the moment when something was said, and it just wasn't mean, it was about bra size, I just went, oh my God, I can't be that big. You know, I just had been oblivious. And I think from that day I became self-conscious. And then close to that day, I got up in front of the class, which I always did. I loved reading the prayer or the daily notices, they were called. And I got up this day and held the daily notices, and I started shaking. And nothing like that had ever happened. And I was having a panic attack, I guess. It was the social phobia had started, and shaking became my thing. And I avoided from that day at all costs speaking in front of people. So I never did that again. I couldn't do my year 12 English oral assignment in front of the class. Like, avoidance stepped up to the max. I did tell my mum, because it affected me so much. And eventually that went to eating and drinking in front of people. I couldn't do, because I'd shake. So anytime I knew someone was watching me and could see me shake, I couldn't do that. So that became quite a challenge.
Wow. Did you find that you became more reclusive as a result of that?
No. And that was part of what made it so hard. Probably a good thing I didn't, because I might never have come outside again. How would I describe myself? Energetic, vibrant, extrovert. So I always have been naturally like that. And so being like that and trying to hide it is very hard, because you draw attention to yourself, but you don't want people to look at you. However, because I was 17, I discovered alcohol at 18. So it wasn't that long I had to. You know, once I started drinking and socializing, I didn't socialize without alcohol. So that's how I disguised it.
Yeah, and tell me, what did alcohol do for you?
Well, it got rid of the shaking. So it was, I mean, that is how I self-medicated. That was a medicine. It's like, oh my gosh, there's something that stops the shaking. However, from my first drink, I couldn't just have enough to stop the shaking. I went overboard. I binge drank from my first drink. I had a half a cup of Jim Beam. I'd never had alcohol in my body. That's a lot of alcohol for someone who's never had a drink. And so I was drunk pretty quickly. And that was after the HSC. And from then on, there was lots of parties. We went to Surfers Paradise and I just drank. So I started out as a heavy drinker.
Were there any consequences to your drinking in the beginning, or was it all pretty fun? Was it just sort of this way to quieten the voice? I'm assuming there was a lot of inner critic going on.
Yeah, look, it was, there were consequences. I mean, I think from the word go, I feel a bit sad for myself back then because I hadn't had a boyfriend, and most people had. And that's because I was interested in other things. I had a best friend and we did other things like Young Talent Time. I was obsessive from an early age. So it didn't matter to me, but then when I was 18 and everyone had boyfriends and I was so inexperienced, I felt really quite lonely. So drinking, I became, that's how I looked for my affection and that when I was drunk. That is horrible. It's not a nice place to be. I know that there was never going to be connections with people because you're drunk. So the consequences were a lot of, time with people I didn't really want to be with. I don't want to go into too much detail there, but the other consequences were I was just messy from the word go. I had people carrying me home. It wasn't nice. I just wasn't myself. And because I drank so much each time, it was just from 1 to 0. I'd have a few drinks and then I'd just be this loud, crazy drunk person. So it took away a lot of authentic times, relationships, memories, they were the consequences.
So you were, like you said, you were self-medicating using alcohol to help with the shakes and with the social phobia. Were you seeing anybody on a professional capacity to start to talk through this stuff, or were you just like, I've got my solution now, I don't need any more help?
I saw a psychologist between 17 and 18 before I was drinking about the shaking and it obviously didn't fix the problem. After that, I think I saw a psychiatrist. So all they did was give me medication. So I didn't really talk to anyone about this for many years. I did the antidepressant type things that I was prescribed and they didn't work anyway because I was drinking. So I just sort of went through on my own. But I mean, it was a long, hard road, to do by yourself.
But it sounds by all accounts that you were still able to manage and get by to an extent, I'm assuming, because you've got three beautiful children. Tell me about that next chapter of your life. How did you continue to tick all of the boxes, yet have this relationship with alcohol that was seemingly unmanageable?
Well, I'll start with like when I was 21, I got a job at, or 20 at Channel 10. I'd always wanted to work in TV. I got the job and I loved it. I was in the newsroom, I was an assistant, and I could hide my social phobia there because no one was really looking at me. There were journalists everywhere, they were busy. It was just a great atmosphere for me, loud. I could, it was great. But they assigned me to auto cue for the news, which is rolling the script. And that was a huge challenge for my shaking. So I spent my time there about 2 years panicking every day that I'd be put on auto cue because it wasn't a daily thing. So it was one of the hardest times of my life because I wasn't drinking when I was at work, but it was also one of the best. So I had that quite often through my life. Something was great, but it was also really, really emotionally draining because of hiding with shaking. So I managed to hide that for 2 years from people, but it was such a burden. And from there, I traveled overseas. I met my cousin over there and spent 2 years there. And, that's a big party for Australians. So I
Mm-hmm.
got by there easy. We did have a time where we were homeless, so we had to get a job in a pub, and that was my biggest fear, was going to be pouring a drink, you know, for someone with shaking. But we had no choice. We were homeless. We literally got put in a pub that night. So I had to face my fear. And that proved to me that actually by facing your fear, you can do it. So I could do that while I was working there. I could pour the drinks and that.
Did you find that you were drinking there because of the accessibility? Yeah,
I still drank. I didn't drink when I was working. Well, maybe a couple of times. And so I literally was just pouring drinks and not shaking. It was interesting because then we traveled, and there was a time in Prague when we were starving and we found this, oh, it's really cheap, let's get this big baked dinner. And I couldn't pick up my knife and fork because I was shaking. So, you know, it was very up and down, and I wasn't drinking that night, so I couldn't eat. And my cousin couldn't work out why, but I couldn't say to her because I can't pick up my knife and fork. If I had said that, I probably could have done it, because once you say something and own it, it's not so bad.
So it was almost like this internalized fear was just so crippling that it's bringing to mind, you know, how we have the fight, flight or freeze response. Mm-hmm. It almost, as I'm picturing it and I can feel it in my body, it feels like you were just in this constant state of freeze.
Yeah. And I think I was, but I was also, when faced with something, I was in flight. So the adrenaline, but I had no control. And so I'd shake. And that's when I'd kind of freeze. So it was a mixture of the two. And it was so often, it was, you know, really, it was hard work. And looking back now, obviously hindsight, but if I had said to everyone, I'm going to shake, no one cares. And that's how you can kind of get past that, because it's like, well, that's what I'm worried about, people seeing me. But after that, I actually met my first daughter's dad in England, and I came home pregnant. How proud moment. Mum and dad. I was 24, and so I stopped drinking because I was pregnant, and I had my daughter, and I didn't drink for about a year after, and that was fine. But then because I was only young, I got back into probably going out once a week, my mum and mine, my daughter. So I got into quite heavy drinking, but when I was socializing, never by myself. And then I split up with her dad, and then I met my husband, and we partied together. You know, it was just big drinking. And then when I had my next two kids, I stopped. That was fine, but I wanted to get back into it. And he's now my ex, but he, when we met, he remembered me from primary school. I had left the primary school three, yeah, and he'd recognize me. So I felt it was very romantic and meant to be, and unfortunately it wasn't long term. But yeah, so that's how we got together. You know, he said, don't you, I remember you from year three. And I said, I left after that and I haven't seen you in, you know, 20 years. I didn't even know you existed. And he goes, oh, I always liked you. So, you know, that's how we got together. I'm like, this is it.
Totally, the stars are aligning.
Oh, I thought, and to a point, it was meant to be. Things don't always work out long term, but we did drink a lot together, so it just enabled me, because a lot of people did, you know, and at home we didn't with the kids, and that was fine. But then my kids, my eldest and youngest, are 10 years apart. So by the time my son was, say, three, I was drinking more, and I was starting to have a little bit at home. So the pattern had begun.
Can I ask, was your separation from your husband close to the time that you got sober for the final time? Like, was there an acceleration of drinking as you were going through that, what I imagine would have been quite a painful, tumultuous time?
Yes. So we were having lots of fights, drunk. And yes, I'm sure a lot of people can relate to that. It definitely worse. Some bad things happened that I regret, some things he probably regrets. But when you've got two people that are not happy in their relationship and you're drinking, that's dangerous. So it really had to come to a head, because the kids were seeing things that they shouldn't, and that was a really big wake-up call. you know, that we were not good together anymore.
I can only imagine how challenging that time must have been for you, and the temptation to lean in on alcohol during a time like that, just to help you get through the pain. I understand it. I was drinking through grief myself, and it became my best friend and the thing that I turned to. I imagine that would have almost multiplied the fear that you might have had contemplating sobriety. You know, how am I possibly going to live life without alcohol, my best friend, this thing that helps to numb the edges when I'm dealing with so much emotional turmoil?
Yeah, look, definitely. And because my kids are at such different stages, I had issues with them for different reasons. And it was exactly, I was numbing because I didn't want to face it. So yeah, I think initially when I did do that 5 months is when we started to kind of break up, I guess. And going back to the drinking was like, phew, I need this to deal with all this. And yeah, it definitely did play a part of making it harder to stop. I'm happy now that I can go, thank God I'm not drinking, because you don't realize at the time how much worse it's making everything, you know.
There was no way
we were going to get out of that, you know, if we kept drinking.
Yeah, absolutely. So then what made the 31st of December 2021 the final time? What did you do differently? What were some of the turning points for you specifically that made this the last time?
So I know, like you said in the intro, I knew something was missing from my life. I was unfulfilled, and I've just always felt I'm here to do something. I'm here to do something, you know, and I knew that I wasn't getting there. I also knew that I had a purpose, I had passion, but I didn't, it was kind of putting the puzzle together, and I'd done my photography and worked with the kids, and it still wasn't it. It just wasn't it. And then in the September of 21, I did the live alcohol experiment, and that was kind of a final piece. And it was, you know what, it's around alcohol and sobriety that is my purpose. And I think, and I do say to people that I had to have that to stop. The difference was I had a purpose, I had a passion. And I do believe most people are going to need something, a purpose and a passion. Or a community. And when I say that, it can be trying art that you've always wanted to do. You know, it doesn't have to be a career by any means. I just think what I hadn't had was something different for my future, because when I'd given up before, what had changed? Nothing. So something had to change. I think working on myself by doing the course through this Naked Mind really, really helped me with a lot of the thoughts and beliefs why I drank. So I think the difference was my mental state was I'm going to really, really look into what is causing me to drink, and I'm going to follow my heart for what my purpose and passion are. I think that's what the difference was.
That's beautiful. I love what you said about how you can get sober. And the really cool thing about getting sober is I always describe it as like the fog starts to lift, and all of a sudden you get to know who you really are when the haze of alcohol is removed. And that may not necessarily mean that you're going to change career paths or go down a different, but you may just find that you love to draw or that you love to sing. And there's this part of your soul that hasn't been nurtured, that hasn't been nourished. And when we remove alcohol, we also get back a lot of time, and you can then invest that time into these things that light up your life and give you, like you said, that purpose and that meaning, which is just so, so beautiful. Tell me, how has your life changed since getting sober?
Oh gosh. Well, it's changed in a lot of ways, and in some ways it hasn't. So I don't want people to think that when you stop drinking, everything will change, because that can be scary. I've still got the same friends, which I'm very blessed with that. They're you know, I've realized how many of my friends aren't big drinkers. Thought they all were.
It's funny, know, isn't it?
Yes, it is funny how that happens. So I feel like what's changed is that my, when I catch up with the friends, like I said, lunches, breakfast, sometimes dinners, I'm not a good night person really anymore. I feel it's more authentic, it's valuable, it's true relationships. So that's changed. I do think back and go, what a lot of missed memories and chances to have real relationships when I was drinking. So the change there is more authentic relationships. I'm definitely looking after myself better. I've always, and I find this with quite a few clients and things, I've always been interested in health. But, you know, so many of us, we do the exercise, we take the supplements and we do all that, but we drink, you know. So now I can finally really focus on the good health. Mm. Because since I was, you know, a kid, I've been interested, or 17-ish, I've been interested in mind, body, spirit, all those things. But you always, I've always been blocking the spirit by drinking. So that's kind of come together. I'm starting up on a career that, because I've never really had a career. So I feel like I've got there, and the clarity, like you were talking about, alcohol recovery coaching. I've got the podcast, which is so exciting for me, because way back when I was four, I thought I wanted to be a cameraman because my dad did ads, and I love cameras, and I worked in TV, I did photography, and now I feel like this is kind of a full circle talking. Funnily enough, I always wanted to do public speaking and I couldn't because of the social phobia. So it's all done this full circle. I feel that's finally I'm doing what my heart or my little me wanted to do. So that's changed. Mm. My kids have I have split up with my husband, and I have my kids most of the time, and I feel they feel safe. That's huge. And just, I decluttered my whole house. My head feels decluttered. So, you know, it's a day-to-day thing. It's still, there's up and downs, obviously, being human. And it's still, I'm still a work in progress, but I just feel there's clarity, and I'm following the path I think I was meant to.
Yeah, that's really beautiful. It's amazing what opportunities lie ahead when we just start to say yes to life. You mentioned that, you know, for the first time, you're finally able to connect to the spirit side of your life. How are some of the ways you open up that channel to connect to the universe or something greater than you?
So going way back, I had quotes on my wall, and, you know, I love quotes and things like that. But I think really, and I always did self-help, read self-help books. I think now it's just, I just feel, I love nature. I feel more at one. I can be really moved by a beautiful scene. I just appreciate things a lot more. I think it's taken till now to realize that life isn't that long, you know, and I want to be kinder and more gentle with people, knowing that everyone has their own crap, everyone. Mm. So I'm just trying to make better choices, not, you know, just not be so judgmental. Just things like that I feel are bringing me back to be more spiritual. I still love, I did art and yoga recently, a day, a bit of meditation. I like short sort of meditations. And I still love a good self-help book and things like that. I think that's how I sort of value my spirituality.
That's beautiful. Yeah, continuing to grow, keeping the channel open and learning. And I just love what you said just then about walking this earth with less judgment and knowing that every single soul is on their own unique journey, and we are all doing the best we can do. And there are some days where we don't show up the best way possible, and there are other days where we do. But likewise, every person that you encounter has their own journey, their own crap that they're navigating. And just to be kind, at the end of the day, like, just be kind, because you really don't know what someone else is trying to navigate at any given time.
Yes. And I'm, like I said, it's a work in progress for that. But definitely it's important, and I'm trying to be conscious of doing that.
Hey Meg, what do your kids think about mum getting sober?
They're very proud. My eldest daughter is, in her 20s, so we talk more about it. Yeah, very proud. And my middle daughter really, really hated me drinking, really felt incredibly angry and unsafe. So we don't talk a lot about it, but she does acknowledge from time to time. What I love seeing is that my kids know they can call me whenever. I'm always available. I tell them, you guys might drink and need a lift home. Call me. Don't ever put yourself, I can give advice now because by no means will I ever tell them not to do things. They're going to have their own journey. Yeah, I just think ultimately they feel safer and more relaxed, but they're very proud too.
That's beautiful. And so they should be. It's a phenomenal achievement and such a beautiful gift that you're giving back to them and now everyone else that you touch in this space. Meg, there's one final question that I love to finish up asking my guests. That question is, what are your three non-negotiables that allow you to live your life today happy, joyous, and free?
Oh my goodness. Oh, well, let me think. One is self-care. And I do think that that's a term that's thrown around a lot. And I don't mean pigging out on the lounge. I do that. But I mean having space for myself and not feeling guilty about it. Is I need that. I need that. That's a non-negotiable. I have to have my space. I need that.
And do you then reach out and ask for help to enable that? Because I imagine with three kids, even though your daughter's 25, you might need help to be able to create that space.
You know what? I did. I reached out to my mother-in-law recently. My ex isn't as involved, and I said to her, "I need help. Can you have my son once a week?" And even just that, not having to wake up and organize him I really appreciate that time. And yeah, so yes, I've learned to ask for help a bit more. Another one is, and probably along the same lines, but it's looking after my health and my body because coming out of drinking, I had a few health issues. One of them was severe leg pain, and it really freaked me out. So it's really important for me to keep up with health, dentist, look after. Now I do a skin routine, things that I'd let go by the wayside. And so that's two.
Yeah, so we've got self-care, health.
And another one is, I guess, just really being my authentic self and making an example of that, especially to my kids, so they know you always follow your heart. Of course, I wouldn't hurt anyone in that process. I want them to know, though, because of what I've learned, follow the intuition, follow your heart, be authentic. And be yourself and be proud of who you are.
That is a beautiful message for us to finish on, Meg. Thank you so much. If people want to check you out, find out more about you or about the podcast, where can they go?
So my website is glassfulfilled.com.au and I'm Glass Fulfilled on Instagram, and my podcast that I do with Bella, beautiful Bella, is not drinking today. And we're on all the usual.
Excellent.
Thanks so much, Ash. It's
Oh,
been
such a
lovely speaking
pleasure.
to you.
I'll pop all of that information in the episode show notes so people can go track that down. Hey, Meg, we say here on Behind the Smile that when we recover loudly, no one needs suffer in silence. So thank you so much for being here today. I've absolutely loved chatting with you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Meg.
A big thank you for tuning in today. If you'd like to support the show, you can do so by hitting the follow button and leaving a rating and review. Each rating and review helps this podcast become more discoverable so more people can hear these stories of strength and hope. Together, we will continue to remove the stigma around mental health, trauma, and addiction. Remember to reach out to those you care about, and I'll be back next week. Until then.